Must be something good in the cafeteria. So I was busy. Spent all day Monday anticipating Tuesday, and all day Tuesday. It was good because I got the chance to finish all the exams. And everyone in this class took the exam, so I was able to release the grades. So overall, I think the class did well. In my book, I didn't see any, I don't remember seeing any F's, so maybe there's only one, which is always a good start because the first exam is always the first taste. With the exception of Iweka, none of you had had me before. So this is your first opportunity to take one of my exams in. And once you took it, you should have seen it was pretty straightforward. There was no surprises. I had questions on everything that we talked about. So if you came to class, took notes, read the chapters in the book, you know, you should have been okay. You should have been okay. Now, the first exam does only count for 15%. Second exam, 15%. So what does this mean? If you did great on the first one, don't get cocky because it's only 15%. So if you do great on the first one, you bomb the next four or three, that's not good. But simultaneously, if you didn't do so great on the first one, just reassess, rebound, refocus, and move forward. Don't forget, there are the chapter review questions. I think for exam number two, there are two chapters. So that if you do all the work there, I think you could add like 5 or 6 points to your overall average. So take advantage of that and earn some extra points. The other thing that you can get extra points for, before I forget, is you got the early submission bonus for your paper. If you started that, that would be due by the end of the month. If you submitted your paper by the end of the month, I think I said +7 or +8, I don't remember what it was. I gotta go back and listen to the video. So there's always that. And lastly, there's one thing a student did send me an email about, and I wanna touch upon, is that for this class, because when we get to the end, there's really only one chapter, maybe a chapter and a half, to earn extra credit with, I have what's called the super mega extra credit pack. But that's only for the final exam. So, again, if you didn't do great, no big deal. Plenty of chance to do well. Because I understand that history is in everyone's bag. And at the end of the day, I want to do everything I can to make sure you are successful. Because if you're successful, that means I did my job. If you're not successful, maybe I didn't do my job well. Or maybe it's on you, but either way, nothing to worry about. All right, so how many of you watched the video? I haven't had a chance to watch the analytics yet. I'm hoping the 90% was reached so that way the class can get some little extra credit. Oh, the other thing is I did go through, for those of you who did the syllabus acknowledgement, wasn't the right amount to get the 5 points. But what I decided to do is everyone who did do the syllabus acknowledgement, I added 3 points in to your extra credit sum total. And I also factored in the syllabus review video. So that extra credit is in my books as well. So when we get time for midterms, those points will be reflected in your average. Although I can't necessarily show them on grade through Engage gradebook, so. But they're there. I keep pretty good records. All right, I think I covered anything. Any questions before I get rolling? All right, Chicago Temujai launched a coup d'etat because he wanted to seize power. He could not be emperor, because under the Japanese system, only direct descendants of the very first ruling family could sit on the throne. So, in and around the 11th century, a secular government position called the shogun appeared in Japan. And it was the shogun who control the day-to-day affairs. He was a military commander. Shoguns were bushi, which were those warlords, like European nobles. They had their own armies, armies of samurai. And they literally battled one another for power, for economic gain. Well, when Ashikaga triggered his civil war, the Sengoku Jedi, chaos erupted. And there would be chaos in Japan for 200 years. Now, I did talk about on the video toward the end, you know, some of the good things that appeared, some of the bad things. But one of the most important factors of Japanese culture that if I had like 10 more minutes to talk about, I would have, was the one thing they all had in common. And this is ultimately what prevented Japan from splintering apart into smaller island nations. The unifying factor was their religion, Shintoism. Shintoism. Now, Shintoism is a polytheistic religion that deals with not worshiping the gods, but rather observing the forces of the gods, or as it translates, the way of the gods. In Shintoism, there are thousands of deities. Some are mighty and powerful, such as the sun, or the sky, or mountains. But some are small and tiny. Well, Shintoism focuses on how to become attuned to the message, the signals, the vibes, if you will, that they send off that appear in nature. Because when a god does something, it leaves the residual impact that can touch upon your lives. These natural forces are called kami by Japan or the Japanese. Now, the more potent the force, the more likely that the Japanese are going to regard them as a deity, a god or a goddess. For example, the most powerful is depicted here. Amaterasu Omakami. She, which is unique in world religions, that it's a female deity that sits on top of the pantheon, is the sun goddess and is recognized as being the goddess of creation, the giver of life. Because after all, what would happen to life if there was no sun? You know, we would cease to be real quick. So, the Japanese worshipped her. And, coincidentally, they believe that the emperor is the descendant of Amaterasu. So, the Japanese revere the emperor as being semi-divine. But there are forces, small, that are not personified. For instance, the chill that you experience in your lungs when you take that first breath when you walk outside your dorm room in the morning. Or the dew that appears on the grass on a spring day. Anything that's manifested by nature is regarded to be one of these forces, a kami. Now, there is no Bible
There's no church. But the Japanese do travel around and make ritual offerings at thousands of shrines that are located all around the homeland islands. And you are free to go make an offering at any shrine that you choose. And offerings are usually nothing big. Any of you ever be gone to Oahu? Hawaii?
You been there? Did you go to the Buddhist temple that was there? Well, actually, it's a Shinto shrine. So, because there's a large Japanese population that lives in Hawaii, going back, it was even before World War II, the Japanese were allowed to build a Shinto temple on the island. And you can go in and you can walk through the temple, and there are shaman there, priests, that will explain the different forces that are in the temple and how you can commune with them. Well, I was lucky that, because I was such a nerd and I wanted to go check this thing out, because at some point I'm going to get to Japan, I just haven't gotten there yet. I wanted to make sure that I was there early, so I dragged my son, we got out of bed from the hotel, we went down the temple, first ones in line. And because we were the first ones in line, the priest allowed me to wake up all of the kami in the temple. So it was done with a ritual gong. They had this large bell, and I was allowed to pull a big sawed-off log and basically gong the bell. And that offering of my actions to create the vibration was said to wake everybody up, all the spirits up. And you could walk around and there was bubbling springs and brooks, there were flowers, there were trees, there were birds, everything was alive. And the shaman would tell you, each one is a manifestation of nature and thus should be revered.
Now, because there's no Bible, because there are no prayers, how you choose to worship is up to you. The shaman or the priests, they are simply the caretakers of the shrines. So they don't proselytize, they don't preach. But you, as an individual, could basically engage in, you know, whatever you feel is necessary to win the support of the gods. Questions? All right, well, one of the most unique things about Shintoism, is that in the 7th century, a competing religion appeared. Buddhism. But instead of all of the Japanese converting over to Buddhism, what occurred was a blend, emergence of Buddhist ideas with Shinto ideas. And again, there are thousands of examples. But I'm going to give you two. The first deals with the kami themselves, and the second deals with reincarnation. Under Buddhist tradition, it is believed that you, as a human being, have the ability to obtain enlightenment. According to Buddha, if you walk the Eightfold Path, in other words, do everything right in life, according to the teachings of the Buddha, you could achieve enlightenment. And you could break the Hindu ideas on reincarnation. We'll talk about Hinduism when we get to that. FYI, the people in India, the Hindus, they believe that you are constantly reborn. You live, you die, you come back in the next life.
And depending on how good or bad you are, that determines what you're going to be reborn into. So if you're a good person, you'll end up with a better life. If you're a bad person, you'll end up with a worse. Well, Buddha came along and basically said it's possible for one person in one lifetime to break the eternal cycle of reincarnation, to get to heaven. Well, when Buddhism came to Japan, the Japanese applied the ideas of reincarnation to the kami. Because in Japan, unlike in India, Japan is more like us. They have seasons. So they use this Buddhist notion of rebirth, born, live, die, reborn, to explain the reason why year after year, winter gives way to spring, which gives way to summer, which gives way to fall, which becomes winter, and it begins anew. So, like all other beings, the kami obtain the karma, the points, to be reborn with the help of the people. So if the people give the spirits enough good points, when spring turns around, the weather will be mild. But if people are bad in the wintertime, when spring comes, spring will be destructive. And so forth. Questions on that? Now, whereas the Hindus and the Buddhists believe in karma, the Japanese in Shintoism, to a degree, kind of believes in the same thing. Except Shintoism holds that it's possible for you to clean away the bad karma. So, if you had a bad day, Shintoism incorporates some form of ritual washing or cleaning. For some Japanese, these are actually very wealthy Japanese businessmen, that one of my friends, who's a field photographer, captured this picture and shared with me. They start their business day, so they show up at 7 o'clock in the morning, they get in a bus, they travel to the coast, and they start their day by ritualistically jumping into the ocean to clean away the impurity of the day before. Then once they, as a group, do so, they get dressed, they go back to work, and they complete the day. The Japanese believe if things get out of balance, if you experience too much impurity, then your life is going to be chaotic. So, adherents of Shintoism constantly try to pursue methods to purify themselves. And by the way, have any of you ever been at a hibachi table restaurant? What's the first thing that the waitress brings to you the moment you sit down?
Sauce.
No, before the sauce gets there.
Drinks.
No, before the drinks get there.
Soup.
No.
Seven.
No. Seven. Washcloths. Washcloths. Before you can eat, you have to wipe the impurities off your hands. Because the chef is essentially, by doing all the dicing and slicing, he's making an offering to you. So the only way for you to enjoy it is to be clean. You know what you never do with the washcloth? You don't wash your face with it, though. You only wash your hands. All right, questions? All right, I wish I could have done that, but like I said, I ran out of time on the video. All right. So now we have Japan blown apart. We have individual bushi becoming super bushi or daimyo.
And these daimyo begin controlling the economies and the lives of everybody in that domain. But Japan was a nation of 300 or so different states. So it was only a matter of time when somebody would come up with the idea of bringing Japan back together again. The individual who would begin the process of reunification after two centuries of all against all was a man by the name of Oda or Oda Nobunaga. Oda Nobunaga. Nobunaga was from a warrior household, so he had the right, because of his birth, to be a warrior. But it was a minor house. So his father and grandfather were bushi, they just weren't daimyo. He, because of his birthright, was trained in the ways of the warrior and would be unleashed as a soldier in his lord's army. And it was on the battlefield that his skills appeared. It was only a matter of time before his daimyo would trust him to lead soldiers in the battlefield. And in time, he himself would rise to the rank of daimyo. He did so by combining all of the qualities necessary to be successful in life. He was daring, he was bold, he was innovative, and he had a ruthless determination. He wanted to win at all costs. To make a cheesy parallel, he was the Tom Brady of his day. He was the GOAT. But here's the thing. He also, in true Japanese fashion, was cruel. If you betrayed him, he would kill you. And he would kill all of your people. One last little interesting factoid. Because he was so bold, because he was so daring, there were three battles that he launched, even though he was outnumbered significantly. The most significant was in one battle, he was outnumbered 10 to 1. No one in their right mind would attack an enemy with 10 times as many forces as you have. But he did, and he won. You know why? The key is in this picture that you guys in the back probably can't see. He was the first daimyo to adopt firearms. See, this is his army. And look at what the guys in the front are holding. FYI, on FX, at the end of the month, they are going to have a mini-series called Shogun. That is not about him, but it deals with this period. Shogun was a book that was written in the 70s, and they made a mini-series in like 1980. I remember watching it as a kid, fascinated by it. But what it does is it tells the story of the first Portuguese ships that accidentally crash-landed on Japan while they were trying to exploit the Asian trade network, which we talked about. And one of the items that the Portuguese had on board were guns, firearms. Nobunaga was fascinated by them. Now, under the code of the Bushido, that's dishonorable. Because honor is about meeting your enemy literally face to face in small arms combat. A gun? You could be on the other side of the building and shoot at somebody and kill them. There's no honor in that. But Nobunaga didn't care because it was the war of all against all, and he was willing to do anything to win. So he got his hands on some of the guns that the Portuguese brought with them, and he ordered his blacksmiths to take the guns apart and copy the parts. So, in just a matter of time, he managed to make enough guns, and Japan already had fire gunpowder, the components of gunpowder they had to have from China, fireworks. So it was only a matter of time before he armed his army with guns. So here's the enemy charging at him in traditional Bushido fashion in their samurai armor, and they're getting blown apart. Because at the end of the day, the ends justify the means. Nobunaga wanted to win. Honor's great, but what good is honor if you're dead? He also was fascinated, unlike other Japanese daimyo, who thought the Westerners were hairy-faced barbarians, basically demonic spirits. Oh, by the way, the Japanese word for foreigner, gaijin, is also the same word they use for enemy. So other Japanese were horrified, disgusted when the Europeans, because of their efforts to take the Asian trade network, started showing up on their shores. But not Nobunaga. And this is proof. This is what he looked like. This is not a photo. This is a hand-drawn sketch that was made of him by a Jesuit priest. So they brought this image back, and this is one of the oldest true-to-life representations of an actual Japanese wolf military figure. He not only welcomed the Westerners, he not only welcomed the Jesuits, he also allowed people in his domain, if they wanted to convert to Christianity. Now, there's no proof that he fully converted, but he didn't try wiping it out like other places. Yes?
Yeah. I just wanted to know if this picture is actually the idea of military men having no beard.
The Japanese, they don't really have good facial hair, biologically speaking.
I'm talking about like in present day,
No. That's because Japanese men themselves really can't grow big beards like other races can. But the why like firefighters, military guys, why they're allowed to have like a handlebar mustache as opposed to full beard? They got respirators. You can't get a tight seal if you have a beard. For the military, gas masks. That's one of the reasons why Hitler had that little button of a mustache, because that was also a popular trend of German soldiers who fought in World War I. Because once you put that gas mask on, if you had any more facial hair, it wouldn't make the seal and the gas would come in and
you could be incapacitated.
Style, Ernest, always has a function. There's a reason why.
Good question.
All right. So, innovative, tacticianer, willing to adopt on foreign ideas to achieve victory. A lot of Christianity, we talked about that. So, ultimately, it would be Nobunaga who would build up enough strength that eventually would wipe out the last Ashikaga shogun. I think it was beyond decimation. decimation actually means something. It's not killing them all, it's killing one-tenth. I think Nobunaga, I think he managed to beat, I think it was something like 20% of Ashikaga's army before the rest surrendered. Brutal, brutal efficiency. But it's when the Ashikaga were toppled that the idea suddenly went in his head. Wait, if I'm winning and I'm beating everybody, maybe I should conquer everything. And maybe I should strive to be shogun. So after defeating the Ashikaga in 1573, he continued to expand his power, in part through war, and sometimes diplomacy. And it was only a matter of time before he was able to gain control of all of this area in gray and purple. This is his homeland right there. But all of this, he either conquered or he managed to form alliances with, making him one of the most powerful leaders in Japan. But Kaishu down here and Shikoku here were two warring states that were completely resistant to him. So in early 1580, he planned a massive campaign to wipe out resistance. But he was betrayed. There we go. He was betrayed by one of his vassals. For a bag of gold and a promise of titles, this vassal sent word to the enemy where he would be one particular morning. Nobunaga woke up early, as he always did, and went to one of the nearby shrines to pray. And it was there where he was surrounded by enemy soldiers. Now, his fight was epic, glorious, killing many dozens of men before he realized that the fight was over and he ended up committing seppuku, ritual suicide. And as he slowly died, the enemy set fire to the shrine and burned him alive. But this is a site. This is a marker of his grave. This is the site of the temple that was set on fire and burned. And today, Japanese travel to the site and they make offerings because they believe Nobunaga is one of the great protectors of Japan. His spirit still watches over them today. So, at first, it seemed like all of the effort that he'd been fighting for 30 years was suddenly going to become undone. But as it turns out, his ablest general would decide to take over the reins of Nobunaga's quest. Toyotomi Hideyoshi moved quickly. The first thing he did is he punished the vassal who betrayed Nobunaga and then continued the campaign that his former master was planning to crush those western daimyo. There we go. Gave rise to an army, moved to the south. But interestingly enough, even though he was adept on the battlefield as his master, Hideyoshi had one advantage over Nobunaga.
He was a master diplomat. So in the end, he didn't need to wipe out Shikoku or Kyushu. Both decided to make an alliance with him when they received promises of basically not being destroyed. Within just 7 years, he managed to do something that Nobunaga did not. And I should have gotten an updated map, but I don't. He would seize full control and dominion over the south, as well as much of the north. Japan was on the cusp of being reunified. Now, FYI, there was a problem. Unlike Nobunaga, who was a noble, Hideyoshi was a peasant. Hideyoshi joined Nobunaga's army, fought fiercely and bravely, and was promoted by Nobunaga. But because he was a peasant, he could not become shogun. But that was okay. That was okay. He wouldn't get the title. Oh, one other thing. I was wondering where my brain was going. He also, if you were to go to Japan and take a class, Hideyoshi is regarded as their George Washington. He's the guy that brought Japan back together again. All right. So while Nobunaga got the wars going, it would be Hideyoshi who brought the wars to end. And then once the wars were over, he brought back effective government. He ended 200 years of conflict by laying the foundation of what the next 300 years would be built upon. He took the social structure of Japan and reformed it. Japan, as we know, because I covered this in the video, you had those different tiers of society. You had the emperor at the top, then technically you had the shogun underneath, if there was a shogun. Then there were the bushi, although the daimyo were above the bushi. And then you had pretty much everyone else. Well, there was no rhyme or reason to the system. But when Hideyoshi came in, he transformed it. He would take... I'll give you a quick visual. He proclaimed himself essentially to be the leader. He didn't have the title, but in all due purposes, he was the shogun. And what he sought to do was make personal relations with all the daimyo, thus making their position dependent upon him, while simultaneously binding them all together under him. So to be a daimyo, you owed your position to Hideyoshi. But Hideyoshi stopped fighting amongst all the daimyo by unifying them. This, ultimately, is what ended the war of all against all, the Sengoku Jedi. Because theoretically, if one daimyo won against Hideyoshi's will, he could deploy everyone else against him. And that rebel daimyo would be wiped out.
And by the way, all the other daimyo were chomping on the bit, because what they would do is he would take the land and all of the riches in their economy and redistribute it amongst all the loyal daimyo. So it paid to be loyal. But again, the key here, and I want to make this distinction, this is where in the end it would fall apart. All of these guys were loyal to him, not to the job. He wasn't a shogun, but they were personally loyal to him. So just to do a little foreshadowing, what do you think is going to happen the moment he dies? Well, everything's going to break apart. Second thing he implemented, that again, that would allow the Bushi to do all this stuff. Him to do all these things. He made it illegal for anyone to elevate in class. All Japanese households, by law, would remain in their current class and occupation. So, if you were a rice farmer, guess what your kids were going to be? And guess what your grandkids were going to be and your great-grandkids? He didn't want anyone doing what he did, rising through the ranks on skill. Instead, he trapped everybody where they were. He also made it so that way you could only marry people within your class. So no love in Japan. Well, why on earth would people go along with this? There was no Second Amendment in Japan. He, by law, made it illegal for anyone other than someone born of the samurai class to bear arms. He launched what became known as the Great Sword Hunt. Samurai soldiers literally went house to house, village for village, looking for anything that was a traditional Japanese weapon. If you did not turn it over and it was discovered, you would be killed. By the way, this is how 5% of the population would effectively control 95%. Because the only ones who had weapons were the people who would benefit from staying in power. And what good are your fists when someone's coming at you in armor and with one of the most lethal bladed weapons ever devised by human beings, the Japanese katana. FYI, just not trying to be political, but that's why the Democrats want to get rid of the guns. Just the same. History shows populations that are disarmed are held in their places. And then, when he ended war, put everyone in their place, disarmed the population, made laws, he then realized, well, I have a whole society based on warring tradition, and there's no wars. So he then did something that had never occurred in the nearly 2,000 years of Japanese history before his arrival on the scene. He decided to engage in imperialism. He dreamed of conquering other lands. Now, FYI, keep in mind, he's alive in the 1590s. The Portuguese
had been involved in the Asian trade network for almost 100 years at that point. And by the 1590s, the Dutch are just starting to arrive, and the English would be there shortly thereafter. So the Japanese, being one of the last land masses in Asia, have gotten word of these gaijin, these hairy-faced barbarians. Heck, they landed on the shores of the islands themselves. So, in part, not only did Hideyoshi want to conquer other lands and make empire, but he also wanted to push the boundaries to create buffer areas. So that way if the Spanish or the Portuguese or the Dutch or anyone tried conquering Japan, they would have to conquer the outside territory first. He sent a couple of probing expeditions that went as far south as the Philippines, which by the 1590s were controlled by the Spanish, threatened them, but never really invaded. But he would launch the Imjin Wars. There would be two. Imjin. Oh, Imjin, not Imjin. Imjin. He envisioned conquering China. Because in the 1590s, he knew that the Ming were starting to crumble. So his plan was to cross the 90 miles of water between Japan and Korea, invade the Korean Peninsula, conquer it, and march north into China. Unfortunately, the Imjin Wars did not go well. He brought a massive force, 150,000 samurai. But it ended up being a quagmire. Both the first war in 1592 and the second war in 1597, they got bogged down. Because the Koreans were not disarmed. So it's easy to be a thug in your own homeland when no one's going to be able to fight back. But the Koreans treated the invasion as if their life depended upon it. They raised armies and resisted. And in the end, they managed to defeat the Japanese. And to make matters worse, he got sick in the second Imjin War and would end up dying on the battle or near the battlefield. So, he achieved success by taking advantage of his predecessor's work, but in the end, failed because of the fatal flaw of his system. He was a peasant. He did not have hereditary rights. So, even though he hoped his generals would keep his son in charge, there was no legal requirement. And he never said which one of his generals should rule. So in the end, the system built on him fell apart when he died. And this would give rise to the man who finally completed reunification. And somebody in here is doing, I think, a paper about him. Tokugawa Ieyasu. Ieyasu had been an ally of Nobunaga and Hideyoshi. But unlike Nobunaga, who came from a minor house, Unlike Hideyoshi, who was a peasant, Ieyasu came from an offshoot of the Minamoto clan, the clan of the emperor. So, if he could achieve reunification, he legally could become shogun.
To accomplish things, the first thing he did was gave up on imperialism. His focus instead was Japan itself. So all of the remaining soldiers that were in Korea were recalled. Everyone came home. He then had to fight a 3-year bloody conflict in which several of the daimyo attempted to take over. But in the end, he managed to consolidate his power. And he beat everybody down and put everybody back in their place. Fortunately, 300 years of violence didn't erupt. It was just 3. But in the end, he emerged victorious. And as recognition, the emperor granted him the title of shogun, effectively making him the military dictator of Japan. The emperor, like I said in the video, was like the pope, a spiritual leader. But the shogun was the secular leader, the man who ran the day-to-day show.
And it would be Ieyasu who would start a dynasty of shoguns that would rule Japan until the 19th century. All right. Questions?
All right. One of the first and most significant things that Ieyasu did was he changed this, which I've already smudged. He got rid of this. He recognized the inherent flaw of tying all the daimyo to himself personally. Instead, what he would do is he would tie all the daimyo to his position, shogun.
He then kicked everybody off their lands. All of the daimyo lost all of their lands temporarily.
And then he took the map of Japan and he began repositioning everybody. From his home territory in his capital city of Edo, which today is Tokyo,
he would redesign the map to protect himself.
In the lands immediately surrounding his lands, he put family members, people connected him through blood. So they and their armies would serve as defenders of him and his armies. Then, surrounding the family were the most trusted friends and allies. And, in a series of concentric layers, he positioned all of the daimyo based upon the clan's history, past events, loyalty. So that way, any daimyo perceived to be an enemy
would be way out here. So in order for the enemy to get to the capital, he would have to fight his way through all of the layers of defense.
Brilliant. Brilliant. Because this almost guaranteed that there would be no wars. Because if you're an enemy, who in their right mind is going to engage on the suicide mission?
Question. Second thing he did,
he ordered that all of the daimyo had to move their wives and their children to Edo. And for 6 months out of the year, all of the daimyo had to live in Edo, under close watch of the shogun. So for 6 months you had to live in the capital so you could be with your wife and children. 6 months you had to go back to your lands. The catch is, your wife and your children would only stay alive if you returned unarmed.
So you could have a procession, you could have soldiers, but you were not allowed to bring your weapons past the friend lair. Here you would be disarmed, and you would go the rest of the way under the protection of the shogun.
Talk about being grabbed by the kahunas. Who in their right mind would do anything that could result in your heir, your son, being killed?
Questions? This is how Japan would have peace from 1603 all the way up until 1863, I think that's when the Meiji Restoration began. So for 250 years, because the central power controlled all of the warriors.
The only other threat, once the daimyo were subdued, would be the gaijin. Those pesky Europeans that are trying to penetrate everywhere in the Asian network to get economic gain.
So, how would the shogun deal with these people? Well, like I said, the first ones to come were the Portuguese, and the Portuguese brought with them goods that they had picked up along the Asian trade network. So they didn't just bring European stuff, but they brought copper and pottery and lacquerware and spices because they wanted to trade.
But, as I've already mentioned, the Portuguese did bring other devices like firearms, which of course Oda Nobunaga loved. But most of the daimyo thought it was dishonorable.
So, what the Japanese needed to do was try to figure out a way to kind of keep the gaijin at arm's length. But they brought a problem with them. The Portuguese were Catholics, and they brought with them Jesuits who would attempt to convert the population. Now, when Nobunaga was around, he didn't care. He actually saw Christianity, Nobunaga, as a curiosity, which I mentioned.
He just couldn't quite understand how could these hairy-faced, smelly gaijin who sail in boxes from the other side of the earth, how they could be so successful worshiping only one god. And again, I'm not trying to be negative or controversial or anything like that, because I'm devout Catholic. But if you look at it from the perspective of a polytheistic individual, someone who worships multiple gods, the notion of having a father who is responsible for all creation, including creating his own son who came down to earth and died for the sins of man. That's kind of interesting. What father in his right mind would want to kill his own son? You know? So it was just bizarre. But Nobunaga was willing to listen.
Hideyoshi, on the other hand, when he came to power, he was kind of like, yeah.
One of the biggest things that concerned him was when he heard of converts refusing to fight in ways that conflicted with Christian beliefs. You know, does not the Bible basically say murder is a sin? Well, the Japanese were brutal. They didn't have morality. They didn't have Christian morality. I mean, they attacked, they killed, they destroyed, they looted, they raped.
So he didn't really like it. Plus, he was really concerned with the potential of invasions. Again, we're talking 1590. He, through other merchants, through Chinese merchants that come, he hears stories of what the Portuguese did when they tried blasting into India and how they started seizing control of places like in Indonesia. And he's really concerned that someday these Europeans are going to bring an army and try to invade his country. So that's one of the reasons why he was preparing for it. But by the time you get to Ieyasu, he was outright hostile.
Any of you see the movie Silence? You saw that one? That tells the story of how the Tokugawa hunted down and sought to destroy Christianity in Japan. Pretty brutal, wasn't it? One of the most telling scenes, which was based on true stories, was how they dealt with those Christians from that Oceanside village when they put the three in the water as the tide was low and basically crucified and let the waves beat them to death in hopes that they recant, and they didn't. Powerful stuff. You should see it. Silence. Very good movie. Very good movie.
It has Andrew Garfield in it, who is Spider-Man. They have that kid that was the new Darth Vader. And I think Liam Neeson was in it. It's a good movie. Definitely. It's good watchable. But ultimately, that movie displays the hostility that not only Ieyasu would have for Christianity, but also all of the Tokugawa in general. They literally hunted down missionaries. They killed, imprisoned, tortured, executed Japanese who converted to Christianity that would not recant, that would not give up their faith. And it would be from this foundation, Christians hunted and persecuted.
It would be this persecution that would lead to the first three shogun after Ieyasu to slowly begin trying to pull Japan literally off the map.
They tried moving Japan to complete isolation by locking down the country. Their goal was to prevent outside ideas from coming in. It began slowly.
1616, they began limiting the ports that foreign ships were able to enter.
In the 1630s, all Japanese were forbidden to trade or sail overseas. If you had a ship, you could only fish. Or if you were going to engage in trade, you only can do it on the Japanese islands. The Japanese also began to specifically ban nations. 1637, they banned the Spanish. They were sick and tired of the Spanish trying to smuggle in Christianity. Outright banned them. And when the English came in the 1660s, they were annoyed by the English. They felt they weren't trustworthy. Ironically, the only nation that was allowed to trade would be the Netherlands, the Dutch, and the Chinese. Why? China didn't bring any dangerous thoughts, and the Dutch, as I said before, they focused on money. They focused on business. They were not pushing religion. They were not proselytizing. So, under the Tokugawa, Dutch ships and Chinese ships could sail to the one port that had an island in the middle, just like the Chinese Canton system. This was the port of Deshima. And the Tokugawa would do exactly what the Ming tried doing. So they're going to control favorable balance of trade. Almost done. Almost done. I'm going to finish a few minutes early. Everything that came in, everything that went out, was to be inspected. Because the shogun passed laws on what goods could come and what goods couldn't go. And when the goods arrived in Deshima, as they showed at the end of Silence, everything was ripped through. Because they were looking for anything deemed illegal, including crucifixes or Bibles. Why? The Japanese, the shogun, would go to war against thoughts as well. So, as a result, you know, this is after when Shogun takes place, but if you watch that miniseries, you'll basically see what the Japanese would do to foreigners that magically showed up on the shores. It was illegal. It was illegal from any non-Japanese person to walk anywhere in Japan other than Deshima. You would be executed on the spot. Thus, by the 1650s, Japan managed to do something that no other nation on earth would even think of doing. They completely locked themselves down. And they held everybody out. While at the same time, holding everybody in. Just random thought popped in my head. One of the weird consequences of this, that's the reason why Japan is one of the most homogeneous populations on earth, or homogenous. Something like 98% of the people who live in Japan are ethnically, racially Japanese. They don't want diversity. And this would be maintained because the shogun's will was absolute. This prevented wars. The government maintained control over all aspects of Japanese life. And the vassal daimyo obeyed the will of the shogun so they could keep their lands. But as we're going to see when we come back to Japan, just like we're going to come back to China, there would be one crack that would open up right at the point when they locked everything down. The Dutch brought with them medical books. medical books. And the Japanese were curious about these because the European level of medicine by the 17th century was on the verge of becoming modern medicine. So just one last thought to throw out there. In a 17th century medical textbook, you could actually open it up and see images of a dissected human being that was in perfect proportion and was relatively accurate. The Japanese open up this and they're fascinated by this because the only medicine they had was Chinese medicine. And if you know anything of Eastern medicine, it's herbal, but to a degree it's based on like meditation and keeping things in balance and like acupuncture and putting warm stones in different places on your body. Some of the Japanese thinkers started saying, do we look at what we always have gone for, or maybe we look at some of these new ideas? This would give rise to what became known as the School of National Learning, in which Japanese began, with their contacts with the Dutch, began having access to European intellectualism. And that would serve as a change. But again, I'm not going to get ahead of myself. We'll talk about that when we come back to Japan. All right, Tuesday, we're going to shift the earth again. We're going to go from Asia, and we're going to go to the Middle East. We're going to talk about the rise of the gunpowder empires, the Ottomans, the Mughals, and the Safavids. Then once we're done with the Mughals, we're going to have exam number two. So my goal is to get the second exam in before break. Because I hate having to come back from vacation and take an exam. So we got a couple of weeks. We'll see if we can get this one in the books. All right? Questions?
This stuff starts chapter 21.
I think it's 21, then I think it goes to 16. Because I have the book stacked in the order that I do it, not numerical chapters. I'm pretty sure the...
Because I was wondering which reflection... I'm just going to start them this weekend.
Yeah, yeah.
That way I get ahead of myself. Exams,
so go through it, and it's the Asian chapter, the first Asian chapter, and it's the first Middle Eastern chapter.
Okay.
Okay?